T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi, thanks for joining us for this week's show. Hope you're having a great weekend. Really appreciate you taking the time out to listen. So much to talk about today, including migraine headaches, disciplining our children, and new vaping concerns. But first, let's start with our co-host, Slew Care's Dr. Nirav Patel. He's the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist. Dr. Patel, thanks for joining us again.
As always, great to be here.
This past week, we heard about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She fell in her office and fractured 3 ribs. What do we need to know about fractured ribs and the recovery process?
Well, I think women are at increased risk of this sort of phenomenon because osteoporosis is higher risk in women. And when you fracture a rib, it's fairly painful. It prevents, restricts your breathing because the fracture keeps moving. And then there's potentially a number of complications that could occur. In the setting of a rib fracture, you're always worried about the immediate injury, potentially a bleeding. There's a couple of major blood vessels that are there and that can cause some substantial bleeding, as well as puncturing the lung, which can cause air to leak out of the lung, and that's called a pneumothorax. And so either bleeding or pneumothorax, both can be very serious and potentially life-threatening and need to be investigated. And there's also the concern of what's called splinting, which is, again, because of that pain, you're not taking good deep breaths and your breathing may be a little off or dysynchronous. And because of that, your ability to cough and clear up phlegm and mucus can be impaired. And then what ends up happening is that that can become a pneumonia. And so that those secretions, that mucus builds up inside, and then you can't really cough it up because it's too painful, or you don't cough it up because it's too painful, and then you can develop an infection. So all of those things are risks in people with rib fractures, and need to be you need to be vigilant for that.
But in most cases, there's usually a good recovery?
Yeah, most people do okay with rib fractures. Again, the key is to prevent some of these complications. Watch out for complications if they occur and then deal with them. Some people need some surgical repair, but most people do fine without that and recover on their own with just pain control.
Another story we heard about this past week is cigarette smoking has fallen to record lows in the United States.
Just 14% of U.S. adults smoke. That's quite the contrast from the 1960s when the rate was at 40%. But the CDC's Brian King says despite the progress, 1 in 5 adults still use some form of tobacco product.
Among young adults, e-cigarettes and hookah are the most common products. And among white adults, smokeless tobacco products are the most common.
He says for more than half a century, smoking has been the leading cause of cancer deaths in the U.S. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News Atlanta.
Dr. Patel, are we making progress?
I think we are making progress. There's no doubt about that. But that being said, more progress needs to be made. Cancer deaths from lung cancer and from smoking-related cancers are preventable. Don't expose yourself to those, and then you won't die from cancer. And so I think it is an important. It's important that we keep tracking this. Important that we are making progress, but we still have more progress to make. And the concern that I have, of course, is related to our young folks, because when they die, that impacts the life expectancy of the entire population.
I always love a good coffee story, and we had another one this past week.
Canadian researchers have found the compounds in coffee that form during brewing, making the drink bitter, help hinder the growth of proteins that are linked to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. Darker roasts created more of the compounds. There's no real difference, they found, between regular or decaf. The study authors say the next step would be to investigate how beneficial the compounds are and whether or not they have the ability to enter the bloodstream or directly affect the brain. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
What do you tell patients about coffee drinking?
Well, I think that this sort of research is exciting, but is not really something that we can translate into clinical practice yet. I mean, I think that if a patient comes and asks me about their coffee intake, I kind of look at them with their entire health in mind. Coffee can cause issues with stomach irritation. Coffee can cause issues with the caffeine load. And so for individual patients, you gotta balance those risks with potential health benefits, some of which haven't really been proven yet. And so I think that at some level, moderate intake is reasonable. But again, it's at a patient, individual patient level.
Is moderate consumption of everything pretty much the way to go?
I think there's certain things probably that moderate consumption is probably even too much. Yes, I think in general, these sorts of things, you know, not too much, perhaps not too little, but definitely in moderation.
There's some old thinking that if your grandparents live to a ripe old age, you will too. But a new study says you can't bank on it.
This new study delivered the scientific bottom line on human longevity. It doesn't run in families. Scientists at the Genetics Society of America examined family tree data on some 400 million people and found that heredity has very little to do with how long we'll live. In fact, they figured DNA accounts for only about 7% of lifespan. So if you think you can ignore that healthy diet and exercise and live a long life like Grandpa did, forget about it.
Well, I think this is a very interesting study because they looked at data from Ancestry.com. And so they took a large data set, 400 million individuals, and then looked at what happened with these folks. And I think that they found elements that were surprising, and that was that the genetic factors had something to do with it, but not everything. And you actually were more likely to be impacted. Your life expectancy was more likely to be impacted by the families and people that you were married into, and your other relatives, sometimes not even blood relatives, and their life expectancies. And I think that speaks to the importance of other factors that are the socioeconomic type factors. If you're more likely to have access to food, clothing, shelter, then you're more likely to live longer. If you have time and, you know, wealth enough to have time to do the exercise, then you're more likely to live longer, as opposed to being in a situation where you're trying to sustain the very bare minimums. And so I think that it's an important factor, and it sort of makes sense even at the ground level. If you and your spouse are compatible, you're more likely to be doing the same sorts of activities. You may be engaged in exercise. And if your spouse lives longer, you may live longer because you're all doing the same sorts of activities. And so I think that that's an important distinction here.
We are talking with our co-host, Lou Cares, Dr. Nirav Patel. He's the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. A new study from the Cleveland Clinic says not exercising regularly could be worse for you than ever. The study calls cardio fitness the key to living longer. What do you think, Dr. Patel?
Well, absolutely. Again, this is one of those situations where exercise is an important factor in making sure that your body is in its optimal cardiovascular performance state. The heart disease, stroke, vascular diseases in general are leading killers of adults, and without good cardiovascular health, you're not going to live as long. So again, related to that last story we looked at, it's sort of the exercise and the environment that really makes a difference in what you do and how well you're going to be able to live.
How much exercise should we be getting and what type of exercise?
Well, the recommendation remains that it's about 30 minutes of cardiovascular exercise that is reaching an appropriate heart rate, and that's done at least 3 to 5 times a week. And so, at some level, any amount of exercise is better than none, and clearly that study shows regular exercise is more important. So going on these binges, which sometimes I know I've been guilty of myself, where you like, okay, I'm going to be healthy this week, and you exercise well for that week, and then you're back down to your routine for the rest of the month, is probably not helpful. More important is to be consistent in your exercise routine.
Talking about exercise, another story took a look at if you are going to do a workout, it might be smart not to have an energy drink right before that.
Want another reason not to consume energy drinks? They could mess up your blood vessels. This is according to researchers at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Strenuous activities like sports and exercise require maximum blood flow, but energy drinks restrict blood vessels, making them less efficient. That could explain cases where energy drinks have been linked to cardiac events. Worst case scenario is when people chug energy drinks to get the full effect in one shot. The study authors say that can be dangerous. Jim Shenaby, CBS News.
Dr. Patel, does that make sense?
Well, I think that energy drinks are, again, one of those fad sorts of things that we need to be careful about. That doesn't mean that there's not potential benefits and there's still more questions regarding the risks. But I think that it sort of highlights the importance that, you know, as we talked about earlier, moderation is sort of the best here. A lot of these energy drinks are packed with caffeine, and caffeine is a vasoconstrictor. And so when you get that shot, if you want to say, of caffeine, you have that feeling of energy, but it also has the blood vessel constriction as its effect. And so a lot of it is going to do more of the blood vessel constriction. And sometimes you need those blood vessels to be free-flowing so blood can be delivered to all parts of your body. If blood vessels get too constricted in certain spaces, especially in the heart or in the brain, then blood flow can be restricted and you can have injury to those organs.
There was an odd story this past week about a boy in Australia who ate a slug on a dare, became paralyzed, and later died. I know it's a rare case, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, it's one of those, you know, here, famous last words, here, hold my beer. It's an unusual situation, but highlights an importance of food safety. In general, we don't eat a lot of raw foods, and when we do, they're typically well-prepared, for example, sushi, but it's carefully prepared, and there's a risk, but it's typically associated with a poor preparation or exposures in the environment. And so in this case, here's a random slug that's walking around or crawling, and you pick it up and decide to eat it. Well, it's probably not been well-prepared, and the parasite is a parasite that causes brain infection, and once the brain infection starts in with this parasite, it's typically untreatable, irreversible. So it's a high risk to eat uncooked, unprepared food in the same way. And you know, sometimes you may be up for these dares or you know, famous last words, here, hold my beer. Probably not a good plan.
Thanksgiving is drawing closer. And every year around Thanksgiving, it seems like this past year, every week, we've been talking about food safety. What are the main things we need to know about food safety as we get close to Thanksgiving?
Well, when you're preparing food in large quantities or something that you may not prepare regularly, food safety and segregation of cooked and uncooked foods is an important thing. So as you're getting ready for your Thanksgiving meal, you want to keep your meats and your vegetables, especially vegetables that are going to be uncooked, completely separated and not cross-contaminate those items. Also, a lot of times in the Thanksgiving situation, a lot of food may be prepared a little bit ahead of time and in fairly large quantities. And so then getting the appropriate temperatures in your food may not happen in the way that you regularly would expect. So ensuring that the turkey is cooked all the way through and through, ensuring that your meats are cooked through and through, ensuring that you have your other vegetables and foods that are prepared that are reaching the appropriate temperature is critical to ensuring food safety. Sometimes, again, food's prepared in advance and then they're sort of allowed to sit at room temperature or without refrigeration for hours, and then that's when you can get problems. And so being very careful and vigilant about all these things is important as you get ready for your Thanksgiving holiday.
Especially when it comes to leftovers, probably, as well.
Absolutely. So the leftovers have been sort of, you know, imagine the scenario, right? They've been sitting around, you know, on the table. You might have had a very long Thanksgiving dinner. People have kind of nibbled at items, and so they may even be contaminated. And then it sort of sat there, and then, you know, you go to clean up, and it's been sitting there. Again, it's been hours. You may be talking. You may not be packing up all the food right away so it doesn't go into the fridge for several hours. And then you take it out and nibble on it some more, and so it may not have really cooled down all the way to the temperature it needs to be to protect it. And so there's potential opportunities all along the way for contamination of the food and then for improper preservation. And both are important factors as you think about it for leftovers and for taking over leftovers from your Thanksgiving holiday celebrations.
So maybe the best thinking is when in doubt, throw it out.
Yep, absolutely. When in doubt, throw it out. If it smells weird, get rid of it.
Dr. Patel, good deal. Thanks a lot. Come back at the end of the show and join us with your health tip for the week.
Absolutely.
SLU Care's Dr. Nirav Patel is the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist. When we come back, we'll talk about migraine headaches and some new treatments. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. According to the Migraine Research Foundation, nearly one out of every four households in the United States includes someone with a migraine. Migraines are one of the top 20 most disabling illnesses in the world. Here with everything we need to know about migraines is Dr. Michael Snyder. He's a neurologist with SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. Snyder, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start out with just the basics. What is a migraine?
So migraine is a disorder that's fairly common in the population, affects up to 23 to 25% of women and up to 8 to 10% of men. It's a recurrent primary headache disorder, and what that means is that it's not due to an underlying cause. We think there are genetic influences, and there's often a strong family history. But the short version is that it's a recurrent headache disorder. And the headaches of migraine are characterized generally by being more severe in intensity, by restricting activity, and most often by association with either light sensitivity or nausea, as well as other symptoms like dizziness.
So tell us about the types of migraines. The one you just mentioned is a migraine with an aura.
So the majority of patients with migraine most commonly don't have aura. They just get the headache, and they can get associated symptoms with the headache, which are most commonly light and sound sensitivity and nausea. About somewhere between a quarter and a third of migraine patients can develop transient or brief neurologic symptoms, which can either precede or accompany the migraine headache, and the term that is often used to describe those symptoms is the aura. The most common aura is a visual symptom, which can be described in different ways or perceived in different ways by patients. It can be anything from having part of your visual field that you can't see through, almost like it's smudged out, to seeing flashes or flickers of light. So any kind of a temporary visual disturbance that usually lasts on the order of minutes. Less common auras would be to experience symptoms such as difficulty speaking, which we call aphasia, or to experience numbness and tingling, especially, for example, on the face or even into the tongue, and sometimes migrating into the upper extremity on the same side.
I know you mentioned that we don't know what causes a migraine, but do you have some ideas what might lead to them?
The general theory is that there's what's called neurogenic vascular inflammation, which means that the nerve endings that supply the blood vessels of the brain start firing excessively, which causes this local inflammatory response. And so the old term for migraine headaches was that they used to call them vascular headaches, and that's kind of where that comes from. And that is actually the rationale or underpinning for some of the new anti-migraine treatments and how they were developed and why they're effective.
How does a migraine differ from a regular headache or from a sinus headache?
Yeah, so I have a lot of patients come into my office and self-report that they have quote-unquote sinus headaches, which often when you dig in the history turn out to be migraines. What I would say the differentiating feature is, first of all, is recurrence. Second of all is the associated symptoms. So any headache that is accompanied by an unusual degree of either light sensitivity or nausea is most commonly going to be a migraine. It's true that you can get headaches from sinus problems, but it's most common when there's an active sinus problem, such as a sinusitis or sinus infection or sinus blockage. So without the other sinus symptoms, if it's just recurrent headaches that are located toward the front, and especially if they're associated with light sensitivity or nausea, then it's actually more common that that's going to be migraine.
In diagnosing a migraine, how important is it for a patient to keep a headache journal?
I think it's extremely important. It really, not so much in helping me make the diagnosis, but it's really critical in helping to guide their treatment and to help determine if a treatment is effective and what magnitude of effect it's having. It can also be very important for the patient to be clued in and help self-identify whether there are consistent triggers or things that seem to be causing their migraines to happen. So usually I'm a strong advocate of a headache diary, which often includes a food diary at the same time.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Snyder. He's a neurologist with SSM Health Medical Group about migraine headaches. We'll talk more about triggers in a minute. Let's talk about treatment. What sort of treatment is there for migraines?
So I divide treatment into two categories. The first category we call abortive treatment, which means we're trying to get rid of the migraine that you have right now. And there's been a class of drugs called triptans, which we've had in some variety for the last 20 years or so, which are, for the most part, fairly effective for most patients. The other group of drugs falls under the designation of preventive treatment, which means that we're going to put you on this medicine, and over time it's going to reduce the frequency and often the intensity of the migraines that you experience. Now, we have a lot of drugs that have been used for that over the years, and most of them were drugs that were repurposed from other indications. There's some blood pressure medications, some older antidepressant medications, and even some drugs that are technically seizure medications. And honestly, we don't even know why some of these drugs have anti-migraine effect, but it's been the clinical experience over the years that they do. More recent years, I think there's been more progress made in migraine preventive therapy. One of the last sessions that we had together, I talked about Botox, which is a treatment that we use for chronic migraine. But just in the last few months now, we've had three new treatments approved for migraine, which all work similarly. So these are called biologicals. So they're a synthesized monoclonal antibody, which means that the pharmaceutical company has engineered an antibody that binds specifically to a neuropeptide called CGRP. And CGRP is one of the chemical mediators of that vascular inflammation that I was mentioning earlier. So this is considered to be a very targeted or specific treatment for migraine, and it's a very desirable drug class because it's not really a drug, and it doesn't really cause any systemic side effects. So it's kind of an exciting time for migraine preventive treatment.
Dr. Snyder, let's get back to the triggers again. What foods can be a trigger for migraines?
So this is probably about 25% of migraine patients can identify reproducible food triggers. So common triggers can include certain forms of alcohol, especially wine, most commonly red wine. Some patients also get it with beer or less commonly any form of liquor. Other foods would contain MSG or artificial sweeteners, certain types of chocolate, especially dark chocolate. For some people, and if they eat any nuts, they can get migraine. So there are a number of things. Generally, the more processed or artificial the food is, the more it can be potentially a problem for people with migraine.
So, doctor, what's your best advice for people who get migraines?
My advice is to what I preach, what I call healthy living, which is good for all of us, but it's especially important for people that have migraine because they have more sensitive brains. So the things that I preach about are adequate quantity and quality of sleep every night, regular exercise and stress reduction, very good hydration every day, and to avoid skipping meals is all of these things can serve as migraine triggers. I do at some point caution them to do a diary, to do a food diary, and see if they can identify reproducible triggers, because obviously if they can, then you'd want to avoid those things as well. I also discuss natural supplements with patients, which can provide, you know, a very modest benefit in some cases. But if people need more help than that, then I'm usually starting to talk to them about either prescription abortive treatment or prescription preventive treatment.
Dr. Snyder, thanks a lot for the help. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Dr. Michael Snyder is a neurologist with the SSM Health Medical Group. Up next, when it comes to disciplining children, how effective is spanking really? You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Appreciate you listening to the show. A new warning to parents from the American Academy of Pediatrics on how not to discipline your kids.
Multiple studies have shown spanking doesn't work, and now the Academy has issued its most strongly worded statement yet against the practice, which it defines as non-injurious, open-handed hitting with the intention of modifying child behavior. The group, representing 67,000 pediatricians, also warns that humiliation, fear, or threats in child-rearing can undermine the parent-child relationship, which it calls perhaps the most important relationship in our lives. Vicki Barker, CBS News.
For more on this story, we turn to Dr. Rebecca Melvin. She's a pediatrician with the SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. Melvin, thanks for being here.
Not a problem.
Give us an idea. What exactly is this new report saying?
This new report is actually revisiting old reports that are encouraging parents not to spank children. There's been kind of some wavering. Some states it's still legal to spank your child, and corporal punishment in general is still legal in certain states, even into the schools. They really are recommending not to ban spanking and other forms of corporal punishment because of the effects on brain development in children.
So explain to me, what happens to the brain when a child is spanked?
When a child spanks, it's sending them messages of negativity. One of the things, it's not only physically harming them, but mentally they may feel less of themselves, they're shamed, they're also hurt. Hormones in the body related to stress can rise, and the brain in general will have a change in brain structure because of those stress hormones. This also happens with harsh verbal abuse. Not only spanking, but shaming and yelling at your children can also elevate those same stress hormones.
Why the update? Why did they feel it was necessary to make this update?
You know, I haven't found exactly why they've made this update other than that it's still prevalent in several areas of the country. I had practiced in Texas also, aside from being in here, and corporal punishment of paddling is still prevalent there. Parents have to sign a consent that they agree to have their child paddled if they want to do that. So in some areas of the country, it's still seen as a normal way to discipline a child. But it's really not the best way to discipline your child.
What are some alternatives then?
The biggest things is really working at how to positively reinforce good behaviors. A lot of times when you yell or spank or focus on the negative behaviors, the children get any kind of attention, and so it's actually reinforcing those negative behaviors. And then some children, when they're spanked more often, especially those under the age of three, who have been spanked at least more than twice a month, may become more aggressive by the age five. You have more temper tantrums, more outbursts, because they learn that behavior. So what I tell parents in the office is, remember the term discipline is derived from the word disciple, which means to teach. We're here to teach our children, not to abuse them in any way. And if you spank your child, yell at your child, you're teaching them. Those are acceptable behaviors. So if you want your child to listen, you have to think about, what are you teaching them? I need to teach them how to listen versus how to just yell or be violent. With children, it's very hard to focus them on the good behaviors when you're stressed out, and then your stress can lead to their stress, and again, increasing those stress hormones. So looking at them and redirecting them to positive behaviors and reinforcing the positive behaviors is definitely the better way to go around this.
So how important then is modeling good behavior yourself for teaching it to your children?
It's very important. If you are also the type, if you're a type of person who lashes out because you're frustrated or angry, that your child is watching you as their role model. They always learn by example. And so if they're seeing that kind of behavior as acceptable in your eyes, then they're going to do those same behaviors.
We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Melvin. She's a pediatrician with SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. Melvin, let's break this down by ages when it comes to our children and disciplining. Let's start with infants. Do infants need to be disciplined, and how should you do it?
Most infants don't need to be disciplined, but again, they can have, they tend to respond more toward positive touch, holding, comforting. They respond more towards the calmness and the calm nature, and they tend to grow in a better way with that type of nurturing.
What about then with toddlers?
Toddlers, it's very difficult because they're frustrated because they can't communicate as well to their parents or even any of their caregivers because their language is just developing. So sometimes they're frustrated because they want to do one thing when you really want them to do the more acceptable behavior. But redirecting them to the acceptable behavior is always the best way to help the child learn what's right, what's wrong. And things, instead of saying, no, don't do that, hey, let's come over here and do this instead because this is a good behavior. You don't have to say it's a good behavior, but teaching them that this is an acceptable activity versus knocking the TV off the TV table.
Sure, sure. And then tantrums are also big with toddlers, aren't they?
Yes, they are very, very prominent in most children or toddlers in general. And most of that's the frustration. Sometimes they're hungry and they just can't tell you, I'm hungry, and their sugar or their body is fighting to get something to eat and they can't tell you, I'm hungry.
What about grade school age children? How does disciplining grade school kids change?
Grade school is tough because they're learning a little bit more independence. They most of those children do know right from wrong if they've been directed in those ways. And if they are learning the positive behaviors, you really focus on, hey, you had a really good day today. And if they have a bad day, say, hey, you know, it may not have been the best, but you had a better day yesterday. Let's work at that again. And really focusing them on the positive days, especially if you have a child who's struggling with maintaining good behaviors on a daily basis.
Dr. Melvin, how do you feel about timeouts?
Timeouts can work. But again, it's parents have to be consistent with their expectations and follow through every time. You can't flex and say, oh, well, this time it's okay for the child to throw the toy at my face or throw the toy in general, and then the next time it's not okay. You have to be consistent and follow through with your expectations. So one time they do a behavior and it's not acceptable, the next time they do that same behavior, you may need to respond in the same way.
What's a good form of discipline, or at least an effective form of discipline, for teenagers and adolescents?
Teenager adolescents is always tough because they are very, very set in some of their ways and fighting for independence. They're really struggling to say, I want to be able to be an independent adult, but yet they're not there, and they don't realize they're not there yet. So some behaviors that can be... discipline is grounding and taking away privileges and reinforcing that certain things are privileges and not a right, particularly video games, going out with friends, maybe giving them chores to do as that they need to do to pay back. They did something wrong, and you say, you know, we got to pay for that. You made a bad choice. Let's go ahead and learn how to make the right choices and still guide them in a way to focus on the positive behaviors, but also saying, you know, you made a choice that was not acceptable. I'm going to need to help with that. And we have certain parameters that are, you know, parents need to put parameters in. And still, again, it's being consistent and parents need to be on the same page.
So, Dr. Melvin, what's your bottom line advice for parents when it comes to disciplining their children?
With disciplining your children, be sure that you are teaching them the core values that you want them to live their life by. Reward positive behaviors. Don't necessarily focus on all the negative behaviors, and also be consistent with your expectations.
And be aware of the long-term harms of spanking?
Absolutely. A long-term harm is there, and you don't want to be the result of that long-term harm.
Dr. Melvin, thanks a lot for joining us. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Rebecca Melvin is a pediatrician with SSM Health Medical Group. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk some more about getting that flu shot and get our health tip for the week. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. We're starting to see some influenza cases all across the area and across the nation as well, prompting health officials to remind people to get that flu shot. CBS News chief medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook was on CBS This Morning talking about it.
Yeah. How effective is it?
You know, it varies from year to year. I mean, sometimes it's 25%, sometimes a little more, sometimes it could be as high as 50, 60%. But the point is that it's better than nothing. And even if you go on and get the flu, it sometimes is able to attenuate, to weaken the amount of flu that you get. So even though you get the flu, you don't get as sick.
Our co-host, Flu Cares, Dr. Nirav Patel, is still here in studio with us. He's an infectious diseases specialist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Talk with us some more about some of these myths surrounding the flu shot, including the one that you can get the flu from the shot.
Yeah, I this one just won't die, and that is that you can get the flu from the flu shot. And the flu shot itself is an inactivated, I'll repeat again, inactivated flu vaccine. And so it is not going to cause the flu itself. You can get some symptoms after that. You can get a sore arm. You can get some pain around the site. And some people can kind of feel like they are a little bit down. But in my mind, that's exactly what you want, because that means your body is reacting against the vaccine and developing the immunity for what could be a real infection later in the season. The other myth to dispel is that how effective the flu shot is or not. The CDC has very strict criteria for how effective it is. And so it sounds pretty bad that it's only, quote, 25% effective or sometimes 50% effective. But that doesn't include the effect that it has, that even if you, for example, do get the flu, that you may not die from it. For example, you might just you might be ill, but you might not be as sick as you could be. So I think that both of those things are important factors. The flu shot, it is imperfect, but it is definitely the most effective weapon we have against protecting us from what is really a devastating pathogen, the influenza virus.
Dr. Patel, while you're here, we're at the end of the show. What's your health tip for the week?
Well, we've had a lot of stories about healthy living and life expectancy and the different factors that can contribute to that, as well as exercise and the risks of associated with energy drinks. I think as we get down to the holidays, it's important that you enjoy your holiday meals, you partake and don't hold yourself back necessarily, but then also be very careful trying to avoid that binge approach to anything. So I think that my holiday health tip of the week is to enjoy in moderation. Enjoy the meals, but don't necessarily go overboard. Do the exercise afterwards, but don't necessarily go crazy.
Dr. Patel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Salute Care's Dr. Nirav Patel is the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at this same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.